Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Sociology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Sarah Patterson, and today I'm speaking with Michelle Silver about her new book, Retirements and Its Discontents, Why We Don't Stop Working Even If We Can. Welcome to the show, Michelle.
Thank you, Sarah.
So can you start us off by telling us about yourself?
Oh, sure. I am an assistant professor at the University of Toronto. I've got lots of different appointments. My primary is in sociology, in the Department of Sociology, and in the Interdisciplinary Center for Health and Society. And that's where I teach undergrads, and I also teach graduate students through the Dalhousie School of Public Health and IHPME. And I've got some more appointments in there as well, in the Institute for Life Course in Aging. But those are my primary titles.
Great. How did this book come about for you?
So this book was about a five-year journey for me. I would say it started really, the inspiration for the book started when I closed my father's practice and essentially retired him. So as a young person in my 20s, my father developed dementia, and it came to a point where it was clear that we needed to close down his practice. And so my siblings did the lion's share of the work with regard to addressing many of the challenges associated with his caregiving. But one of the things that I did was take out his files and close up his office. And that experience really reinforced the significance of work on individual identity. And by essentially retiring my dad, while he really wasn't fully aware of what, you know, wasn't really fully able to process the significance of what was happening, I think that process sort of led me to take on more of the potential implications of what retirement could mean, because for him, work had been a really important piece of his life. So you know, at that point, near that point in my life, I started a PhD at University of Chicago, and when it came time to think about my, you know, focus, I realized that retirement was something that I was, you know, really interested in learning more about. And so my training at University of Chicago is really largely in econometrics and modeling. And so I looked at retirement trajectories and the relationship between the type of work someone retired from and health outcomes, measures like depressive symptoms. And, you know, the point was sort of to do this modeling over time to look at, you know, in relation to how people fared in, you know, sets of years after retiring relative to how they were before retiring, sort of trying to address some of the concerns in research on health and retirement. And anyway, so like needless to say, I spent lots of years studying data points and thinking about what it meant to be retired and what this construct was, and looking at and thinking about different ways that economists define retirement, that labor force status matters. And I guess, long story short, I eventually was able to do some qualitative training later and to get some funding to do my own studies. And there, that sort of led me into one of the first studies, which then led into what was five different studies that are the heart of my book, Retirement and Its Discontents. And there I was able to do qualitative interviews with subsets of people for whom their personal identity was very deeply intertwined with their work identity, and for whom retirement was a really challenging and interesting transition.
So you said your dad was a doctor, but how did you come to choose your sample? And then also, can you explain more about your methods and the sort of the reflection that you have in your methodological appendix, which I think is interesting as a researcher myself, in terms of your position, you know, at your age, and then, you know, interviewing your participants?
So, my dad was a social worker, and his transition really, it led me to think a lot about what it means to be retired. As you mentioned, in my appendix, I describe how it's really important for me to reflect on my own potential biases as an interviewer, as a researcher, and to recognize that, you know, for one, I have never retired personally, right? I have this somewhat personal experience with it, but I haven't done it myself. And that's really important because there's lots of beautiful books that have been written about the experience of retiring from people who made the personal transition. So, So I guess on the one hand, I cannot be accused of research. On the other hand, you know, I'm writing about something that I didn't personally experience, that I just became fascinated with. And that's sort of important too, right? To acknowledge that it is a topic, a social construct, a phenomenon, retirement, that I find fascinating, and not everybody does, right? And so, you know, I sometimes tell people that I study retirement and their eyes gloss over and they're like, wow, how boring. And I'm like, no, actually, how interesting that we have this term that everybody knows and that's so widely used, and that nowadays pretty much everyone is expected to think about or make the transition to, and yet nobody really knows what to expect. Sorry, can you tell me again, you had a bunch of questions there, and I want to make sure I'm hitting them properly.
Yeah, so you answered basically what I was asking, but in terms of how
yes,
you chose
okay,
your sample.
So well, yeah, that flows quite well from what I was describing, which was that I was really eager to talk to people about their retirement experiences when I first started my career as a, you know, professional, as an academic. And so the first sample of people that I interviewed were homemakers, and that's the last subset that I talk about and whose stories I share in the book. But that was the first group that I got funding to do a study with. And they really were, and I think still are, the most extreme example, because no economist would ever define a homemaker as a retiree, or let someone who said they were retired, let someone who had no paid labor force participation, identify as a retiree. But I did a larger study about women's retirement experiences, and a subset of that study was focusing in on women who self-identified as having been homemakers and identified as being retired. And so, you know, from there, from that study, I sort of followed up with a subset, and did, you know, repeat interviews with women who told me about, you know, what it meant to be retired and what their experiences were like going through that transition. And I know we'll talk about that, a bit later as you, you described the format of for our conversation. But I'll just say that, you know, even though they are quite unique as a subgroup, they were quite unique and heterogeneous within themselves, like from one another. I also have done quite a bit of work looking at physicians' retirement, and so from there, how did I get the sample? Was I actually was contacted by a chair or head of a department of medicine who said, "Hey, I heard you study retirement, and we're having some trouble with the physicians in our unit with regard to retirement. What do you think about doing a study and helping us think through some of these issues?" And I obviously am so grateful for that experience. It led into a whole number of different studies about physician retirement, and in particular academic physicians retirement, which is sort of a exacerbated role because there's so many sub roles within the umbrella of an academic physician, right? They're not just doctors, but they're also academics and are responsible for teaching within medicine. So that was another study that sort of followed from having identified as someone who studies retirement. From there, studying academics was a sort of natural follow-up in another study that I did. And then, interestingly, the campus that teach at, one of the campuses I teach at, but my primary campus, University of Toronto Scarborough, built an athletic center for the Toronto Pan Am Games. And it became the best and, you know, most fabulous athletic facility, particularly with regard to the pools and other aspects, other features in Canada. I think that was in 2015. The building was you know built. And anyway, what happened was I had some other projects going there, and I was interacting with some very young looking people who identified as being retired. And anyway, like long story short, from there I connected with a set of people who were former Olympic athletes from all over the world. Eventually, I was able to connect up to a sample of people who were, yeah, from all over. But, you know, this facility brought in coaches and trainers from all over the world. And anyway, I eventually uncovered that many of these individuals were athletes themselves, and in fact, very elite, high performance athletes. To the extent that they had, represented their countries at the Olympic Games. So that sample sort of came out of, the luck of being on a campus that had a world-class athletic facility. Not everybody I interviewed worked at the facility, but it was a really great launching pad for being able to talk to people who identified as retiring from elite sport. So I think I covered all the groups. Oh, the CEOs. I also interviewed CEOs, and that came out of giving a presentation about physician retirement. And afterwards, a gentleman came up to me and said, "That was a really interesting talk about, you know, physician retirement. A lot of what you said seems like it might be relevant to CEOs." And I looked at him and I was like, what? Did you not hear a word I said? Like, how is that possible? That's, you know, this like totally different world. And he said, you know, well, have you thought about studying and interviewing CEOs? And I honestly was just like, okay, this is unlikely here. But he then identified as having just retired from having been the CEO of a large medical institution, and said that, you know, while there were differences, there were a lot of what I had said resonated with him, and that, and then he acknowledged that he thought it would probably be a little bit different, but worth pursuing. And kindly sort of helped me get that sample going of people who had retired from the position of having been a CEO. So that's each of the samples in the book. You know, the sort of short story is they were each studies of larger studies of individuals with these work identities. And for the book, what I did, as you mentioned, as I describe in more detail in the methodological appendix, the people I interviewed for the book are subsets of those larger studies. They're people who I sort of pulled out as having struggled with the transition to retirement, and who I interviewed repeatedly to talk about that, to talk about what it meant to retire, what they thought, what their expectations had been about retirement, what their work experiences, you know, initially, you know, to talk about what their work experiences had been and what they thought retirement was going to be like. And then to talk me through their transition to retirement and experiences as a retiree.
So you start with doctors, and here it's an interesting example because people are just completely devoted to this work. And I thought it was interesting that your participant, Emil, says that he even felt like a deserter. So I was hoping you could tell us more about what the doctors experienced in their retirement.
Yeah, Emil, for example, he described his retirement as feeling like a renegade, right? He felt like when he retired, like he had deserted his life's work. And the physicians that I interviewed, the stories that they shared showed how their strong personal connections with work had a price. It included low engagement with their family commitments and with other spheres of interest in their life. Some of them talked about not really having time for hobbies, or if they had hobbies, that their kids were their hobby, or things that other people might take issue with describing as hobbies. They talked about, you know, retirement as a challenge because, you know, for example, friends described how fun it was to play golf and, hey, let's go play golf now that you're retired. And the physicians explained to me, you know, I've always been really good at what I do. And I've never really had time for golf. So, you know, all of a sudden the idea of going and getting on the golf course when it's something I'm not particularly good at is entirely unappealing. You know, I've always been good at what I do. So, you know, eventually the key characteristics that made them great doctors, their total commitment to their work, was also a key barrier to finding contentment in their retirement. I talk about the greedy institution that is medicine, and how from an early age, physicians are acculturated to, you know, focusing in on their work. They're woken up when they're on call in the middle of the night and expected to immediately shift into that, you know, work role, which sometimes requires that they make life and death decisions. And so, you know, to go from being 150% for, you know, to giving all of that of yourself to zero was really a challenge.
And another interesting example from the chapter on doctors is Walter, who's a rural doctor. So I was hoping you could talk about his sort of interesting perspective that he brings to this retirement issue.
Sure. Yeah. So Walter's story was really quite interesting, in that he had a really hard time replacing himself, because, as you mentioned, he was a rural physician, and eventually, you know, the bottom line to his story was that he eventually found two people to take over his practice and to do what he by himself had done, you know, which is also quite remarkable and telling. But, you know, he's also a sort of contrast to many of the other physicians, because, or actually many of the other people in the book, because many of them talked about or expressed the sort of sentiment that, you know, the institution will fail without me, you know, that like people, you know, just can't carry on. And so, you know, how can I retire and leave everything? And that's something that's come up in some of my other studies of, in particular, academic physicians. But Walter was, you know, eagerly trying to retire, trying to find someone to replace him, to find a successor. You know, at one point he tried to give away his practice for free and couldn't find any takers. And it was quite a struggle. You know, when his wife got very ill and eventually passed away, he really wanted to give up his practice, but it wouldn't be for another several years that he actually was able to make that transition to retirement. So, you know, his was a real struggle for a number of reasons. And I would say, you know, maybe one of the biggest contrasts in terms of the stories that are shared in the book.
So then you move on to CEOs, and some of these people were actually forced into retirement. So I was hoping you could talk more about that.
Yeah. So the CEOs were really quite remarkable. You know, media representations and advertisements foster these images of wealthy retirees playing golf and enjoying the fruits of their labor, you know, going on cruises, you know, sitting in side-by-side bathtubs at the edge of a cliff overlooking the ocean, right? Like you've seen these airbrushed media ads, and they really portray this idea that, you know, retirement is a time to enjoy the fruit of your labor, and who better to enjoy the fruit of his or her labor than, you know, a CEO, someone who often retires with great wealth and, you know, has, you know, achieved the highest ranks of professional engagement for their field. And yet the CEOs that I interviewed for this book, had excelled at developing their careers, but they were not as good or not as competent at developing a life that was distinct from their work identity. And so, you know, each of them advanced in a career that rewarded deep commitment, like the physicians. And, you know, similarly, their work tended to penetrate every aspect of their life. But then at a certain point, usually around 60 years old, they were expected to relinquish that position of power and to forgo that part of their identity that had been such an important source of fulfillment for themselves. And so I would say in various ways, they were forced into retiring. Some of it was self-imposed, right? So one of the stories that are shared is of Ted, who had been the CEO of a large non-for-profit health plan organization. And he talked about, you know, having this idea in his head that he needed to retire at 55. And, you know, some of it had to do with his, you know, father's retirement. Some of it had to do with, you know, media ads he had seen that linked that age 55 with retiring. You know, he described how at 55 he had worked for over 10,000 hours, so he, you know, met that minimum level of commitment. and had, you know, missed quite a lot of his children's lives and upbringing and that sort of thing, that sort of fell to his wife. And he got to a point where he just had this idea that retirement would be a great experience for him. And so in some ways, I would say he forced himself into it. Then much of what I talk about, what is shared, is his experience of feeling, you know, no longer grounded, of sort of feeling the rug pulled out from under him, yet he pulled it up. He pulled it out himself. And his story, I think, is sort of echoed through several of the other people who are interviewed in that chapter. Another one, Bob, another CEO, talks about retirement in a way that is sort of akin to a mistress, and talks about how when he retired, he found himself sort of secretly thinking about work and wondering if somebody would call him or pick up the phone and just like let him know that he was still desirable, that he was still needed. And yet, you know, part of the role of CEO is being the one where the buck stops, being, you know, an independent decision maker. And so it's very uncommon, I learned, for CEOs to call their predecessors, because that could be seen as a sign of weakness. And so it's actually indeed quite rare for them to pick up the phone and call each other. So it can be quite isolating to retire from the position. And so he describes how, you know, like his heart was still fluttering, wondering if the phone was going to call or he was going to get some kind of message asking him, you know, a work-related question. And you know, how he eventually came to terms with realizing he's better off without that. But some of the other stories, I actually interviewed women for the study. The paper that I have that's coming out soon is called The Unbearable Lightness of Being Retired. And that paper is a study of a larger subset of CEOs and includes women, and is sort of novel in that way, because there aren't many women who reach the position of CEO. One of the individuals whose story is shared in more detail in the book is of Claire, who was the CEO of a private hospital. And at a certain point, she was forced into retiring because her board learned that she was diagnosed with cancer. And so, you know, she shared the information with someone, and within a few days, her board had arranged everything. And the public announcement was made that she would be retiring almost without consultation with her. It was just assumed that's what would happen. And she talks about how, you know, she had worked her whole life. She had worked from the point of early adolescence. And so her entire adulthood had been spent working. And so the idea of not working was devastating. And at one point she said she didn't know which was worse, the cancer diagnosis or the being forced into retiring. And so, you know, there's several stories that are shared there, others that are more explicitly about, you know, this idea of being forced into retiring, but, you know, where like there would be, you know, a notice or stories in the news saying that the individual was retired when in fact, you know, they didn't see it that way. They just sort of got shuffled into it.
Yeah, I found those to be really interesting examples from that chapter. And from the discussion of the CEO's retirement, you also bring up some terms I'm hoping you can give us more context for, which include productive aging and what is often referred to as the third age in this literature.
Yeah. So yes, I talk about productive aging and this idea that that we have, that is, that to be successful, we must be, you know, committed and giving back economically to society. That, you know, in some ways there are strict notions of productivity. And these strict ideas really made the transition to retirement challenging for the individuals that that I interviewed, because, you know, when they tried to do what their wives did, when they tried to emulate the day-to-day experiences of their, you know, retired friends and largely partners or spouses, they found it incredibly unfulfilling, because they were so used to having a sense of identity that was linked to being productive. And so this, you know, this concept of productive aging or successful aging has received a lot of ink. There's been a lot written about it in the gerontology literature, in the, you know, health and social science literature, and, you know, particularly as it relates to aging, because, you know, it suggests that there are specific ways to age well. And, you know, for those who are less physically able, who face, you know, health constraints and issues and caregiving burdens, et cetera, you know, there's been a lot written about how this notion of aging can really be quite difficult. And here, I think what I introduced that is somewhat novel is just this self-imposed idea of what it means to be productive and busy, and how that can constrain experiences or enjoyment in, you know, what has been termed the third age, or this, you know, phase of life, which is supposed to be for leisure, for enjoying our time. The third age has been described as, you know, the time of life after we stop working, we're no longer caring for children, and no longer, you know, facing the pressures of having to engage in economic activity for work. And yet it comes before the fourth age, which is, you know, marked by physical decline and deterioration and dependence.
So then you move on to elite athletes. And here it's interesting because their life and their work is based around the singular goal. And often they refer to feeling like a stranger in their own bodies after retirement. So I was hoping you could talk more about them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in sports, everything can change in the blink of an eye. You know, elite athletes go from being the best in the world suddenly to being completely out of the game. And their experiences are really quite interesting, because they start to play on, you know, what we think about when we think about retirement and what it means. And they also, you know, start to hit home the idea that chronological age should really be decoupled from retirement. One of the key points that I try to make in the book. But they also have really interesting and I think quite exciting stories that they shared. As I mentioned, each of the elite athletes that I interviewed had participated in an Olympic Games. They represented their countries around the world. But at a young age, they retired from their sport. And when they returned to the, quote, normal world, they describe feeling like foreigners in their bodies and in their mind, because their ability to focus on an adrenaline fuel goal served them really well when they were Olympians, but it created great discontent for them when they struggled to find a new purpose in their life as retired athletes. And so, you know, the average professional athlete's career is over by 33. And most Olympic sports, the retired athlete, you know, they retire even sooner. So, you know, the stories of the athletes that are shared in the book range from, you know, very young individuals who are still reflecting on their youth and talking about and sort of justifying their use of the term retirement. And yet making really clear that the transition was both physically and emotionally devastating. to, you know, individuals much, much later in the life course who had been athletes early on, but then went on to experience a number of different careers. So the chapter sort of moves through a set of individuals that, you know, the first woman whose story, Allison, retires at 21. The last person in the chapter, Omar, retired runner, retires in his 70s. And it's a range of individuals who retire and are interviewed at, you know, midpoints in their lives that are shared in between. And I think, you know, their stories are really, you know, stories about early retirement, but they're also stories of resilience because they each had to find new ways to engage with the world and to engage in economic activity because, you know, quite simply, they couldn't afford to stop working. I mean, even the athletes I interviewed who had contracts and endorsements, none of it lasted long enough to really allow them not to go back to work at some point. And so, you know, they talk about this idea of, you know, losing your sense of purpose. If I can, I'll just read you a quote from Allison, who I mentioned, who retired at 21. She had been a gymnast. And she says, this is a quote from her. She says, "It's really scary," she's talking about her retirement, "because you lose your sense of purpose. What's interesting about retiring is all of a sudden my name is still the same, but I'm not a gymnast anymore. I remember it being really weird the first few months when you meet people and they ask you, 'What are you doing?' And you're like, 'Nothing. I'm not doing anything right now.' Even when I was 7 years old, I was constantly working, you know?" And so, you know, she explained how, you know, she entered into competitive gymnastics around 4 years old, and she trained every day for at least 8 hours a day. She did have one day off. Sundays she had off, and those would be her day to rest with her fellow athletes. But really it was a day to rest only so that they could, you know, be at full capacity the very next day. And they were quite, you know, limited in what they could do for fear that they might injure themselves or do anything that compromised their ability to compete again the next day. You know, she moved away from her family, as many of the athletes I interviewed did, in her, you know, before 10 years old. And, you know, live with other families or with coaches so that she could focus on this work that consumed, you know, at least a decade of her life. And then, you know, eventually went to compete for her country at the Olympics and, you know, was at an all-time high. And then stepping down from the podium was, for many of them, and in particular for Allison, sort of devastating experience to, you know, sort of suddenly enter the quote normal world or the real world without ever really having much experience having done so. You know, each of them described how when they traveled for their work, for their athletic competitions, they had teams of coaches who, you know, choreographed every move they made and also structured the most of their day. So, you know, they would get off the plane and somebody would, you know, maybe they had to like carry their own luggage, but that was about it. I mean, somebody had coordinated exactly like where they would go next, what they would eat, where they would eat it, what they would wear, and then of course what their routine was like in terms of the training and in Allison's case in terms of the routine that she performed with her teammates. And in many ways, they were sort of like the CEOs in that several of the CEOs I interviewed described how they had several administrative assistants, some had as many as three, who also, you know, planned out their day. So they would go into work having no idea what their schedule was going to be. They would just sort of, you know, get there and find it planned out for them. And often that included dinners and you know, all the way in or in evening activities, which were a part of their work. So similarly, when they retired, they were sort of left at a loss because first of all, they couldn't figure out how to use like a personal planner, right? Because that had all been like programmed for them. They knew how to use it, but you know, some described not knowing how to program it and missing lunch dates because, you know, their administrative assistant had always planned it for them. Well, anyway, similarly, the athletes, they really struggled because they had not had much time to think about how to structure their day because it had always been structured for them. And because, and I would say uniquely, because their goals, their work goals were so complicated. I mean, you know, Olympic athletes represent the very limits of what humans are physically able to do. And that required true dedication and commitment. And it didn't leave them time to think about what came next. They couldn't really achieve and focus on their goals with a plan B in mind. They had to just keep their eyes on the prize. And that's what allowed them to achieve such incredible feats in terms of their physical accomplishments. You know, they all talked about how they knew they would be replaced if they weren't up to speed. And so, you know, to keep up, like literally up to speed, they just had to focus on their specific goals. And that just didn't leave time to think about what came next. But then when they talked about what came next, it was quite interesting because nothing that they did could give them that high that they achieved as athletes. And so, you know, like I said, they all went on to do other work, but none of the types of job, you know, some went on into coaching. That's very common, right? Because that's what they knew how to do. You know, some went on into professional business endeavors. One went into paramedicine. You know, they went into types of work that, you know, presumably require energy and pressure, et cetera. But they described how, you know, nothing ever lived up to those highs that they felt when they were competing. And that was kind of similar to the doctors who talked about the highs that they felt when they were performing surgery or, you know, consulting about a client. Or a patient, or, you know, making a diagnosis, that sort of the importance of their work as doctors also gave them a sort of high that just wasn't replaced by the types of decision making that they were doing in their retirement.
I want to pick up on something that you mentioned for the elite athletes, and that's the idea of being replaceable. So this shows up again when you talk about the professors. So I was hoping you could talk more about the professor's experience of retirement.
Yes, yes, fantastic. So to transition to the professors, right. So certainly we as academics are, you know, replaceable to a certain extent. And then there's this notion, there's this phenomenon we have, the tenure process, which, you know, suddenly means a job for life. And that's really interesting, right? Because even in, you know, a field where you know, once you have tenure, you suddenly have a job for life, there is this assumption that you'll retire. And so you know, while you're still alive, right? So it's a little bit ironic, and yet it's something that universities around the world are dealing with, right? This idea that there's quite a bit of sort of conflict even where we're trying to make room for young academics because the mature ones won't retire. And there's lots of tensions. I'm quite sure maybe not every department, but within every university in some department, you'll find a sort of concern being raised about why won't certain people leave so we can replace them. And that's actually something I've written a bit about within medicine as well. These tensions are not unique to academia. but it is something you might be familiar with. And the interesting thing about the professors that I interviewed was that pretty much each of them retired in a way that allowed them to keep working. So they each actually did retire. Some were sort of forced, or I'd say pressured into it through, decision-making in terms of roles they had to make or pressures. One of them was sort of pressured by her husband to shift into retirement. That was Sylvia. One of them was pressured into retiring because he, his department sort of cut him out of the new space they were all moving into. And one of them actually faced mandatory retirement because the country he lived in still had that. But what's interesting and unique about them was that they found these ways of continuing to do their life's work. And I describe this in the book as working in place, a sort of play on the notion of aging in place, which is a common term to describe living at home or in a familiar setting later in life, as opposed to relocating to a sort of healthcare environment or an institution like an old age home or long-term care facility. And in the book, I describe this notion of working in place as a work lifestyle that's characterized by continuing to do the same type of work that you've always done, despite identifying as being retired. And so the professors in the chapter that whose stories are shared, they came from different disciplines. They lived in various regions of the world. They had very different work experiences in academia, but they each shared a common interest in trying to find different ways to do the most fulfilling parts of the work, to continue on. So they didn't, many of them let go of like certain teaching responsibilities, and just focused in on writing the last book or the last set of articles or they didn't even say the last, but the next set of research that they wanted to focus in on. And some of them did exactly the opposite. Some of them gave up on the research goals and just focused on teaching because the university still needed them. A couple of them did it, with no compensation at all, but because it brought them fulfillment, it made them feel needed. I mean, they were. They are somewhat unique to the others, despite having this similar common ground, which is that their work identity and personal identities were so closely intertwined that retiring was a quite devastating experience. But yet they used the factors that made them really good at what they did, the fact that they had always been autonomous, the fact that they had been creative, and that they had carried out their professional endeavors in ways that they made work. These were traits that helped them to readjust within their retirement and to sort of overcome some of the discontent that they felt by focusing in and doing the autonomous, creative things that they had always enjoyed doing.
Another part of the professor's chapter that I found interesting, and maybe it's because I'm an academic myself, is this idea that David talks about his wife saying after he gets tenure, oh, now we can have a good life. And so retirement's kind of the same. People don't understand that their identity is really tied onto their work.
Right. Yes, exactly. David explains to his first wife, when I get tenure, I'm probably going to work harder. And that's probably what ended their marriage, as he explains, because His wife had a really different notion of what an academic self was. And so, yeah, I talk about this idea actually across many of the different groups that I interviewed, because they each had this idea that who they were was what they were, right? What they did represented more than just a job. It was who they were. And so, right. So, you know, you see David carries on and well into, you know, multiple marriages and multiple sets of children and grandchildren later, he's still working. And he talks about how he could have made a lot more money probably, you know, in another type of work, but, you know, that wasn't his primary goal.
So then in the last chapter, the last group that you look at homemakers, and here you talk about sort of undefined retirement and retirement mystique. So I was hoping you could talk more about the homemakers.
Yeah. So the homemakers, like I mentioned, they, you know, would not fit any economist's definition of a, you know, of a retiree. So I talk about them as sort of undefined, as sort of, you know, pulling or stretching the boundaries of what we understand retirement to mean. And that's sort of important, you know, in the bigger picture, because the whole idea of the book is a play on Freud's civilization and its discontents. It's a sort of play on this idea that, you know, there's a conflict between an individual's quest for freedom and then societal norms that restrict our primitive instincts, right? So Freud argued that, you know, social norms, rules, laws that state, for instance, that we shouldn't commit adultery or, you know, physically harm each other, that those limit our possibilities for freedom and contentment. And yet as a society, we agree to live within specific boundaries and to follow certain norms that help maintain order. And then here we have this concept of retirement, this phenomenon, which is, you know, supposedly all about freedom and boundaryless. And yet when we sort of agree to abide by it, then we are sort of struck with this sense of discontent for these individuals that I interviewed. So, you know, the point is certainly not to generalize. I talk quite a bit about that throughout the book and in the methodological appendix. But the point for these individuals is that sort of freedom that was associated with retirement was quite a challenge. And the homemakers are really a sort of play on what retirement means, because these women that I interviewed identified as being retired. And yet, you know, they had all the freedom before, supposedly, right? And you know, they made these transitions based on, many of them made it based on their husband's retirement, or based on social cues that they observed, like getting mail that identified them as, you know, letters in the mail that identified them as being retired or going to community centers and whatnot, where they were just sort of labeled as a retiree or encouraged to enter into activities or given discounts because of that and sort of given benefits because of it. And so they are a sort of interesting play on the construct, because their stories illustrate unique challenges that they face, but also unique freedoms that they encountered as retirees, and that sort of push us as a society to maybe loosen up in terms of the ways in which we define retirement, to say, you know, let us separate it from chronological age, and let us also recognize that even people who aren't or haven't been paid for their work still can identify with their life's calling or the work that they did, even if they weren't paid for it, as something that is important, and that when they transition away from it, it is a valid transition that, you know, deserves recognition. So, to illustrate that point, or the sort of heterogeneity of their retirement experiences, there's one woman who kind of stands out to me, which is Teresa, who identified as a retiree, and she explained to me that for her, it was actually a socially acceptable title that she found preferable to any of the others that were available to her. So as a young wife and mother, she really struggled in that time to conform to the rigid expectations that she faced for being a wife and a mother. And in, you know, around the time I was interviewing her, she was really struggling to connect with her children. She wasn't thrilled about identifying that aspect of her personal identity. She had divorced at that point, and so she described how she also wasn't particularly thrilled about identifying as a divorcee. But retiree was quite appealing because it was ambiguous, and it suited the way that she preferred to identify herself publicly. And so, you know, her experience was very different than some of the others. Also, in the chapter are stories of women who sort of whose, you know, identification with being retired coincided with what other people might refer to as empty nest syndrome. Another woman whose story is shared talks about the challenges with being a widow and how that, you know, impacted her transition to retirement and the way she saw it.
Yeah, if we had more time, I would love to talk more about the sort of intersection of gender, unpaid work, and this categorization of retirement. But we'll just have to check out your paper on this on your homemakers interviews. But I was hoping here you could kind of give us the big takeaways and the big conclusions from your book.
Yeah, absolutely. The main takeaway is this need to sort of decouple our association with chronological age and retirement and the need to confront the mismatch between an idealized and an actual retirement. The book is a subset of stories, right? The heart of the book are these individual and very personal accounts of transitions to retirement. But the bigger picture is at the societal level, is to say that we ought not to assume that disengagement is mutually beneficial. So in the first chapter of the book, I plot out the gap that has emerged between life expectancy and standard traditional or average retirement age across Canada, but also the US and the EU and several regions of the world. And you see the pattern from the 1970s through the current time. So in the last, you know, half century, a real gap has emerged. And, you know, it's due to the fact that we live in remarkable times. We are in an unprecedented point in human history where we are now living longer than we ever have in all of human existence. And this means that we need to rethink, the sort of expectations that we have. And so, you know, a real quick takeaway is to say your father's retirement is not going to be reflective of what your own retirement is going to be like. And, you know, part of the book I talk about, early pension systems and the way they were designed, quite simply, to coincide with the age that most people were already dead, right? So like when retirement systems were first established, the point was that on average, the most recipient or, you know, the average recipient would already have passed away not be able to get it. And that's what made them sustainable. And so the, you know, the takeaway is that, you know, we ought not to undermine the social good by underestimating the true value of experienced mature workers.
Today, we've been talking with Michelle Silver about her book, Retirement and Its Discontents, Why We Won't Stop Working Even If We Can. So what are you working on now, Michelle?
Yeah, well, so thanks, Sarah, so much for asking about that. I've got two projects. One is actually to study further the retirement mystique that I started to explore in the book. And so that is something that I'm focusing on more, the sort of idea behind the mystique that is retirement and the ways that women's work experiences are both heterogeneous and lead into a range of different types of retirement experiences. And so those trends I described, you know, the gap between life expectancy and retirement age are even greater when we focus in on women's experiences. Another project that I just received a SHRC grant to explore is one that focuses in on the athletes that I mentioned. And to focus there not only on the sort of challenges that they face in retirement with regard to the, you know, personal implications and the identity aspect, but to focus in on the physical aspects as well. Because as much as they talked about the emotional, discontent that they experienced, they also talked about how challenging it was for their bodies to adjust to being retired. So the next sort of continuation of that project is a book that I'm working on that looks at and continues to ask questions about how perceptions about aging develop and how they influence health behaviors like exercise in later years.
Sound really interesting, and we look forward to reading them when they come out. So thank you for being with us today.